Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Grace Bell returns to the program she was on last month. So happy to have Grace back for part two. Grace is a certified facilitator of the work of Byron Katie, and she's also a counselor, a certified counselor. And if you haven't heard our first show together, which was January 7th, please go to the archives and listen to it because it's excellent. But we're going to talk some more, and especially about the work of Byron Katie, and because Grace knows a lot, she is a certified facilitator. Welcome back to the program, Grace Bell.
Thank you, Diana. Lovely to be here.
So glad you are. And so just tell our listeners, I think some of our listeners might have heard about Byron Katie because she's become kind of famous, and she was, for instance, well, this is just one thing that I'm aware of, and I may quote some of it later, the show that she did with Oprah on Oprah's Soul series, but I know mm-hmm. Byron Katie's been internationally well-known, but how, I know some of the story because it's a pretty dramatic beginning, how she got, how she got the idea of the work. Can you give us a kind of an overview of Byron Katie and how it started, and then the questions that she asks, which are so helpful?
Yeah, no, I love. She does have a very dramatic story of really what she has spoken of as over a decade of plunging into deeper and deeper depression, and probably what we would diagnose as mental illness, like agoraphobic, locking herself away and not even going out anymore, and just terrible depression and anxiety and agony, it sounds like, and then had a huge consciousness shift, kind of an awakening, like all in one moment in time when she was with the way she describes it, she was sleeping on the floor because she thought she didn't deserve the bed, and kind of woke up out of a sleep and didn't identify immediately as herself. Like, this is who I am. It was kind of seeing things in a dramatically different way, and feels that the awareness of, oh, I was believing everything I thought. I've been believing all my stressful and traumatic thinking, you know, being identified with my own mind and my perspective, everything that's mine. And kind of in that moment, without all that articulation on it, but really just seeing, what if I don't believe it, there is no suffering. You know, with the suffering, believing what I think, suffering. Not believing what I think, no suffering. And so as I understand over time, different aspects of doing the work have come into more structure just to help people understand, like writing a Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, which is the first step, identifying what are those stressful thoughts, and then asking four questions. And I believe like early on, really there was three questions, but the first one kind of needed a double review, which is it true? Like what I'm actually thinking, is that true? And then part two or second question, can I absolutely know that it's true? So in other words, if I answer yes, well, yes, that's true. Yes, it's true. Can I absolutely know it? Just to pause and give a little more time, not that saying no is the right answer, because it's whatever it is, whatever genuine answer is for you. And then the third question is, what happens? How do I react when I believe what I'm thinking, this concept that I'm thinking, this belief? And the fourth question, which is amazing and sometimes hard and tricky to do, is,
yes,
who would you be without the thought? Who would I be without the thought? Some of us will be like, what? I'm not sure. How do I think? How do I do that? But it's fun to use the imagination for who you'd be without the thought. I wonder what that would be like if I didn't believe this stressful thought. You know, just doesn't mean you have to drop the thought. It's just an exercise, but it's very interesting and helpful because it's kind of like, for me, giving some mental space and energy to what that would be like and new possibilities kind of come alive, or just a sense of peace. Wow, if I didn't have the thought in the moment, peaceful. And there's other things to explore there. Who would you be without the thought? And then the very last step of doing the work is finding turnarounds, which is just trying on opposite ways of looking at your original belief, which is a very interesting exercise in itself. So we can even do one to, as an example. So that
yes, let's do
know.
One. Let's
yeah,
do one.
Yeah. Well,
Let's back up, though, just a little bit.
Sure.
People can go online,
yes,
and find the work.com, isn't it?
The work.com, exactly right. And they'll see Byron Katie talking about it in an introduction and all the worksheets and different steps that you need. You can even download just about all the material for free, completely for free. Yeah.
And it can be very helpful. I did watch, and we may talk about it later in the show, I did watch her on with Oprah on the Soul series that Oprah does from September 3rd, 2016. So I may talk about that because lots of people know Oprah, of course, and it was a fascinating interview, and it's on YouTube. It can be found.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. Yes.
Wonderful.
So let's have you give some examples of how this works, the turnaround process.
Well, you know, I love one of your favorite topics here that you're helping people so well in the world around is sexuality. And there's a lot of stress about it. And, you know, one of my top topics that I help people with is eating, and there's an overlap. I mean, it's very interesting for people with eating issues to look at sexuality and just being seen and attraction and all of that. And anyway, there's like stressful thoughts in both realms. But
just pause for a minute, Grace. You said you've seen when we were talking off air, you said this was in an email, where you've seen eating issues arise about being seen or not seen. As you explain this, can you expand on that a little bit? Because this should get you into the rest of what you want to discuss.
Yeah, good question. Often I find, especially kind of what we're calling eating disorders, really eating, but this can be mild, like just an endless stream of on diet, off the diet, on the diet, on, you know, kind of agony about that. Let's call that a very, very mild kind of form of an eating disorder. So that's what I'm referring to. Doesn't necessarily have to be the extreme anything that would be diagnosed as an eating disorder. But people suffer a lot with that. And in many ways, it's tied to why do they want to change their food and eating and start messing with it? The usual, like the flow that you might have like when you're a child, is because I want to be seen a certain way, and it feels critical. Like, I don't want to be rejected. I want to be accepted. I need to look like that. I have to not look heavy. And then equally, almost like cognitive dissonance at the same time, I'm scared to be seen. I don't know if I really want that. Maybe that's dangerous. It might be better to be not noticed, but there's all these ideas around being thin and looking perfect and trying to get like that and avoiding heaviness. I'd never want to be fat, fat phobia, you know, stigma of that. Anyway, it seems like it gets really tied up with how we're seen and then sort of conscious and unconscious things that are going on there. And when it comes to sexuality, my goodness, then it gets big. The volume gets big up on it.
And yeah. Grace, don't we really need a dramatic shift in cultural attitudes?
Oh, I mean, gosh.
So many yeah. people think success is being thin, and of course, young girls take that in. You did. You had, we talked about this in the show we did last month, but.
Yes, I did. Yes, you bet. Right.
So you're a real mm-hmm. expert because mm-hmm. you've lived
yes.
it.
I've walked the walk.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
I know,
you've walked the
like
walk.
It just felt imperative. Like, I don't care if I'm peaceful or not. I absolutely must be thin. You know, like, I'll let's just give, you know, I don't care what I'm feeling or what I'm thinking. That's really, really, really important. How I look is really critical. But it's got like this, like, almost like a matter of life or death. Like, it just, I mean, people are so critical of themselves, like not having the perfect body or doing it right. It just gets really intense. It's like such an intense, and then they'll criticize themselves for caring so much about this thing they shouldn't care about. So, you know, or like, why am I caring so much about this? It's okay. So it's kind of funny, just the energy there, the running of that voice, internal voice that's talking at us. And
you had an opportunity to hear a number of women in your eating peace retreat. But before we get to that, because I do want to mm-hmm. get to that, but we're still, I'm trying to stay in terms of our outline. But the step-by-step process, the stressful beliefs around sexuality and eating, and they're certainly both are intertwined in a lot of ways, and often, and you brought this up in an off-the-air conversation, and it is so true, sexual abuse is often the foundation for both eating disorders mm-hmm. and sexual dysfunction.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. It certainly has sparked, you know, I mean, it's sort of been a big trigger, the traumatic experience, you know. And so that's a good place for noticing stressful, very stressful beliefs, you know, like it shouldn't, like, it's affecting my whole life. It should never have happened. My life would be better without it. And we're not saying that isn't necessarily true, but it's just noticing that stream of thinking, that voice that I'm talking about, like, and how it affects the present. Like, what have you heard that's common thoughts that people say? You know, I need to keep myself safe. It's dangerous out there. It's dangerous.
Oh, yes. Well, in terms of eating disorders, I've heard women say, especially after we've done some work so that they have a little more access to their unconscious, a little more self-awareness, mm-hmm. say, well, you know, I had this sexual abuse and I didn't want to test my popularity again, so I got fat. I could hide behind my fat.
Mm.
And compulsive overeating is an eating disorder. It's one of the eating disorders, compulsive overeating.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of like noticing, a very, very difficult, traumatic experience, and we're not ever saying that it wasn't, because, you know,
exactly.
that it's not. You're right. But just noticing how it carries forward. So with the work, you then begin to think, it's almost like the mind is, it'll take whatever past experience we had and apply it to the future. Like, that could happen again. I need to be careful. I need to watch out. I need to be cautious. You can't live life freely. Bad things can happen. It's kind of got a real stream of negativity. And, of course, you could feel a lot of compassion for somebody thinking that way, like we all do. Watch out, because in an effort to be protective. And yet, it can really limit and diminish your life. Like, you're not, you know, somebody be very, very cautious, very protective, and say, well, you know what, maybe it's better to just never really get into any committed relationship, and having something like freely sexual, like just, I don't want to go there. You know, let's just put the brakes on that.
And then, of course, what you're risking, what that person is risking, is potentially a lot of depression and bitterness.
Yeah.
And feeling kind of stuck almost in their own trap. Mm-hmm. To risk is to risk, yes, but not to risk is to risk even more.
Yeah.
And to feel confident enough to move forward and take a risk requires some good self-esteem. So in terms of the counseling that you do with these women, and I do, it's really important for them to go deep and figure out what are some of the foundations of this.
Yeah.
And we can always move back to the step-by-step, but let's talk about your Eating Peace retreat, because you just held this, and I'd love for you to tell our listening audience about it. And you said you were so inspired by the amazing women who were attending. And so I'd like you to talk about that. And
that's kind of a good segue even into giving an example in a way of like some what people are working on there. But they're coming at the Eating Peace retreat, so bringing all of themselves and their whole history with them, and there, because they are not having eating peace, they're having eating war, you know. And I spend all day with them into the evening, and every meal we eat together. And I guide everyone with mindful eating. But in between the times of eating, which I call a self-care event, we'll have a self-care
event. Okay, that's good.
You know, it's wonderful. And because there's been so much of a mixed feeling about food and the dangerous food, dangerous world. Can't, you know, watch out. I've had so much failure with it. That people don't have a good relationship, you know, with eating and food. And sometimes, yeah, sex and sexuality and relationships, of course, as well. But so they're in between the times we spend the meal times and eating and talking about these inner feelings, we will be doing the work. We're doing the work on something like, because difficult things happen to me in my life, that traumatic experience or things to the body, you know, or related, then it means I need to be very, very careful. It means something bad could happen again. And so the first question is it true? And, of course, people, if you have a logical answer, you might say, well, yes, it's possible. But can you absolutely know that it's true, something bad will happen unless you're careful? That's a really interesting question.
It is.
You know, it's like the way you're holding, just making contact with other people and in the world when something difficult's happened to you in the past. Can you absolutely know it's true? It's going to repeat itself. You better watch out. Or just noticing the energy of that, you know, how you get kind of...
The energy of that that's often tied up, too, in my experience with people who've had sexual trauma, is a hypervigilance. And
yes.
It starts often very early, like if they were abused in elementary school, they start looking around all the time. When is the next bad? Who else is going to hurt me? And that hypervigilance, and so that, of course, tampers down lots of spontaneous behaviors that, you know, one should have as a young girl.
Yes, Really, so true. And mm-hmm. yeah, it kind of darkens the. And then even if something does happen, or you have an exchange, or something difficult, or I don't know, something even like, because we'll be treating almost our way we're being with food and eating the same way. Something goes on, or you eat too much of something. Oh, and then the negativity towards the self. You should have known better. You should have, you know, you have a difficult encounter with somebody who you kind of like, who you were attracted to. Gosh, you should have known better. It's very self-critical. That kind of a vicious voice sometimes can come in, you know, for some people. And overall, very stressful. Very stressful. Not friendly.
Not friendly. Yeah. You've pointed out that both of these things, eating and sexuality, have shame, a lot of shame at the foundation.
Oh, my goodness, so much shame. Oh, yes. And, people, I mean, so common to look at whatever's happened and then not want to get support or talk about it because shameful. I felt so ashamed of the way I ate. Like if anybody could see what I am doing with food, if I'm eating and eating, you know, like, or if there was a camera, oh my God, it'd be so terrible. And it was just like mm-hmm. mortifying. And people feel the same way about their just sexual interest and sexual experience. And, oh, that didn't go well. Oh my God, so embarrassing. You know, and it's kind of their topics. Like, I sometimes think there's a old moral, overarching kind of moral things that are in the culture that we don't, even if we're not religious, it's like, don't be greedy and don't have lust, right?
Yeah, well, that also has bad. Religious yeah. church kinds of
yeah.
foundations
yeah.
too.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, you know, it's like, wow. Anyway, it's hard carrying that. Very difficult, and hard to be yourself, that's for sure. You don't even know what yourself is anymore sometimes. Like, something's wrong with me will be a strong thought.
And what's wrong with me?
Yeah, you know, something's wrong with me. So it's really good to notice. It's like in that question 3, how do you react, and what happens when you believe because something difficult happened to me, something traumatic happened to me, it means I have to be very, very careful and watch out and always be scared and worry about, you know, other people. And, you know, this, I have to be worried about it. That's what it means.
So Grace, what happened with your group? I know you said you were with them. You did mindful eating. Did you experience what is often true with group experiences, which is kind of that there's a universality that I'm not alone in this. And in group work, when one person is working, another says, oh, yeah, I can identify with that.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a very powerful process. Can you talk about your eating peace retreat that you just had and how that played out?
It is so wonderful to notice, you know, the sense of when people really get, they come together as a group and realize there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not, you're not the only person in the world that has these thoughts or these experiences. You know, we have our unique lives, but it's we're not alone. Then the sense of relief and even joy of being able to share and be honest and be real and expose and not have to hide anything just becomes palpable. It's like the group usually only takes about 24 hours for it to start, for people to really sense being, you know, the safety of revealing what you've been thinking and believing in your life and what's driving the behavior that's off balance with food or eating or any other behavior that's compulsive, you know, compulsive thinking. And so it's really, I think, just bringing it out and kind of exposing it. It's like, it's a huge shame buster. Shame just falls. It's such a relief not to be ashamed of oneself. And yeah, the group comes together so beautifully, and there's something very special and powerful about group work. I did group therapy long ago, and that was a giant, that pretty much was, when I was doing group therapy, it was the final thing that I did, and all the different therapists I saw, and the inpatient treatment, and everything. The group, in the end, was at perfect timing, and that was the thing that from that point forward, I no longer had any weird eating episodes. No more binge eating, no more starving myself. That was over. And it was basically from really seeing that I was accepted and people didn't run out of the room. It was weird. I had such a sense of like, I'm the worst person in the world. And that didn't happen. And so I felt this acceptance that was really what I was always longing for. It was wonderful. So I think the power of group.
It was wonderful, and you are wonderful, and that was, you had so many aha moments. I did run for a while an eating disorders group when I was in California, in the Bay Area, and that was illuminating, but for a much longer time, I co-led two women's sexuality groups over a course of about 7 years, and Dr. Maria Flaherty and I co-led the groups, and these women had all experienced sexual abuse, and they were having troubles with orgasms, because to have an orgasm, you really have to feel safe, and you have to be able to let go, and you have to enjoy your body and not be all inhibited about it. And that all gets often derailed with sexual abuse. And some of these women also did have eating disorders, but most of them were complaining in the groups that I co-led over those years about having difficulty with the sexual relationship. And and not having orgasms. And then many of them did go on. They got better. And that's the work that we do with people, Grace, where you can see transformations in this person you're working with. And my goodness.
So inspiring.
So that's inspiring. True. And you know, you and I are in professions where we can't age out. And for me, that's, you're younger than I am, but for me, that's important. And in fact, I think for you and for me, people often gravitate toward people that have experience and have lived it.
Yeah.
Now, I was lucky. I didn't have an eating disorder and I wasn't sexually abused. And I came out of a pretty healthy family. But that doesn't mean that I don't have tons of empathy and that I gather information and that I really want to help people. So you don't always have to have been there, although I'm sure your having been there really informs you in many ways. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, sure can. I think because there's so much shame and there's things that also get even just driven right down into the unconscious, like I don't even want to know some of the things that are there is what kind of what people will, it's difficult to see. Because of experiencing it and walking it myself and then kind of seeing, like, to me, it was like a very slow, like dawn, very slowly waking up. You know, nothing necessarily studied, but just seeing, over time. And that was to be able to hold that and, like, be with somebody and have them talking and kind of see their body language and their how they are and just be with them, like meet them there where they are, just really be with them, nothing to force, is really, can be very, very helpful when there's so much hidden shame about this on this particular topic, but to have already experienced it, like, I think I get the sense of, I'm feeling what this person is wondering about over there, and they might not be able to articulate it well, you know? And I think that can be really helpful. But you're right, you don't have to have walked every single thing, you know, to be helpful. That's for sure. You don't have to have gone through the same exact everything.
No. As long as you're compassionate and empathic and you've got the EQ going on. But Byron Katie talks about the mind wants you to defend the thought, to defend it.
Yes. So you got your...
So how does that work?
Yeah, I found that so interesting. It's kind of like, you know, the example of the one we're kind of looking at here, like, I better watch out because something bad could happen again. You know, something terrible.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's like, it'll say, yep, you better watch out because look. And, you know, like whatever defense, I like to think of defense as being a jury, you know, and they say, well, here's one good reason to defend that thought, like make sure to keep it in place. Don't let go of it, even though it's stressful, because, you know, it's true. It happened, and that was really, really terrible. And you have to never forget it, in a really intense way. You know, like where you're carrying this burden, or better to be tight and cautious. Like if something bad happens, you know, they'll just have a lot of good reasons to keep your stressful thought.
Keep your stressful thoughts.
Yeah. It'll defend, kind of defend the way you're seeing things.
To do what?
Like defend the way you're seeing
things. Well, you said defend, yeah.
Yes.
The way you're seeing things.
Yeah.
So I found under Byron Katie's, the work, the Oprah, the interview with Oprah from... Well, actually, there were several parts, but I only had time to watch part two from September 3rd, 2016. It's under the Soul series. And so it's just Byron Katie and Oprah talking. And Oprah said she began to read Byron Katie's book. What's the title again?
Loving What Is. Yeah.
Loving What Is, yeah. I need to get that book.
Loving What Is. Yeah.
Loving What Is. So apparently Oprah had started to read it, and she said that night after she put down the book, she started to feel sick. And then partly inspired by Byron Katie's book, Oprah said she stopped fighting it, fighting the feeling of being sick.
Mm-hmm.
She finally went to sleep, and she woke up feeling well. So that was something for Oprah to admit. And so Byron Katie said, what is your main thought that you want to challenge?
Yeah.
And Oprah said, without hesitation, I believe my body is too large. And... So that has led Oprah to be bitter and depressed. But Katie pointed out, it's too large. It's too large, but it's yours. And then Oprah was able to say, yes, and it gets me around, and I'm able to do what I want to do. And I thought that was very interesting. And then also Katie encouraged Oprah to feel, because Oprah said, what, you never have had to suffer? Never had to suffer even when her mother died? That is, Katie's mother died.
Right.
And Byron Katie said, well, I don't believe my stressful thoughts.
Yes.
And and so when I'm feeling sadness or I'm feeling love, and with death, I can often see her. I can see her after. And that's been my experience with a late husband who died. And I can often see him. And even with my father, who was hit by a truck when I was 14, I can see them sometimes. I can see, and also, forget my mother, who did die at 95 a couple of years ago. But you can see, you know, their love is still with you, and you can see them if you want to. So it's maybe less sadness and more love. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, just love that. It's really looking at, in many ways, this work of Byron Katie and that I love to practice and do is, it's made such a difference in my life, is unnecessary suffering, like whatever suffering is, which is repeatedly thinking the same, the stressful things that you have about, you know, your perspective. It's like having a pair of glasses on that's just, that are, you know, bitter, upset, resentful, angry, sad, terribly, terribly sad. Not that there's not a place for grief in this world, but, you know, kind of holding that. And I love that from that Oprah interview, which I've also seen quite some time ago. The thought, my body's too big, because often that thought is what will keep the cycle going of off-balance eating of any kind. My body is wrong. It's too big. I have to lose weight, or I have to keep my body thin. If it is already thin, I got to keep it. So there's this gripping feeling about that. And to just do that fourth question, who would I be without that thought? Sometimes people will be like, I can't not think it. But who would I be without that thought and everything that's connected to it? That I really, it's like absolutely fundamental. It's a scary but critical, have to make sure that it's the right size. I don't like the size it is. How do you treat the body? Not very well, you know. Sometimes we hate our bodies if they're not doing it the right way. And but who would you be?
Well, that's also, don't you think, for some women, unconsciously, I would think even with bulimia. I'm not treating my body well. I'm just going to just stuff my mouth until I can feel no more. Absolutely. And even if it makes me feel sick, so you're not treating your body like a temple when you're doing that.
Exactly. You sure aren't. Mm-hmm. So it's like that, there's something wrong with my body. It's too large. I don't like it. And that, even people that are extremely thin or become anorexic, which I had a 2-year phase of that. I have to keep this. I will not eat. You know, and there's kind of, it wasn't peaceful. Wasn't that, people think it's so wonderful to be thin. And then some people have noticed that kind of gripping sense of keeping thinness is very stressful, hard way to live. So
a very hard way to live. And, I think we touched on this last time, but perfectionism is one real predictor of anorexia.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
Anorexics, because anorexics are prone to be orderly, perhaps obsessive-compulsive in their thinking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they're often relentless when in pursuit of a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then bulimics often suffer profound mood swings, and as well as high anxiety, that they often feel intolerable.
So
then the anxiety disorder often underlines anorexia and bulimia. And so when some women who are treated, when they stop the behaviors, anxiety breaks through because it's no longer masked.
Yeah.
And that's a problem for lots of women, and why treating eating disorders is very difficult.
Yeah. I think even your average dieter who's endlessly worrying about losing 20 pounds or kind of always critical of themselves, there is also an element of daily life anxiety and finding relief in eating and then not hating themselves for doing that, you know, kind of like not being satisfied either. It's just maybe a lower level, but it still feels quite debilitating and difficult. And one thing I like about the eating peace retreat is that everyone's in there together. There's no like special, oh, the anorexic and the bulimic, all kinds of different, this is a funny thing to say, different flavors of the same.
Flavors, yeah.
Of the same fruit. We're eating of the same bitter fruit, you know. But seeing what the thoughts are, just hearing and seeing what the thoughts are, amazing, you know, like that are anxious. Anxious thinking kind of leads to all kinds of compulsions, right? I was talking the other day to somebody about their compulsion. It was a dear friend. Her compulsion to, speaking of compulsion, tick off the to-do list, like make sure that every single thing that's on the list is actually done before she can relax. And I thought, very interesting. Like, it's just kind of a lighter, we mostly think of that as a wonderful, it's a great compulsion. Then you're a real doer and shaker and you get things done and all that. But
yes.
She was just noticing, you know, like lack of peace around herself, even if she was very tired, not letting herself relax until the list is all done. And then we were kind of joking and laughing about it, but that's a great, even that with doing the work of Byron Katie, you know, being able to say, I have to get that done before I can relax. Is that true? Who would I be without that thought? You know, who would I be without that story? Living my life, having a moment of like just resting a moment, taking a deep breath. You know, sometimes people think I can't let go of the list because then I will be a lazy good for nothing that won't do anything. But that's another great thought to question. Can I know it's true that if I don't have a lot of stress about getting everything done, like speaking of perfectionism, can I, am I sure that I won't, that I'll just swing the whole other way and never get off the couch? No, I might actually be interested in doing a few things here and there or quite a bit of things, you know? So it's kind of an interesting balance. I think of it like one way as nice to put it is with the thought, it's as if the thought and the whole belief system is a pair of glasses that's really kind of looking through glasses with kind of a negativity, like a sour or fearful perspective. And then it's like you put those glasses down and let's say you put on glasses that were full of more possibility. It's okay. It's even okay. Everything that's ever happened to me, it doesn't mean it's ruining the rest of my life. You know, just having a little more openness and relaxation, different pair of glasses than with the thought. So
a different pair of glasses. Yes.
Yes. I just like that because it's kind of like you can look around and look at everything because if you have glasses on, you everything that you look at. So including if you feel like a nervousness or tension around sexual experience or sexuality, or sometimes for women, it's like I'm, or some men too, for sure. I can't speak up. I can't really say what I want or ask for what I want, or I shouldn't even be wanting what I want, you know, all the thoughts. Well, if we just relaxed and put on a different pair of glasses about all that, so it was all okay. Everything's fine. No shame. It's okay to be experiencing any feeling, and maybe with just the specific thought, like, and I can speak up. I can talk about it. I can talk about my feelings and ideas or what's going on around sex and sexuality. It's great. Then it feels more loose. Who would I be if I had that way of looking at things?
So what you're talking about is reframing, experiencing it, and experiencing the turnarounds that Byron Katie and you talk about, the turnarounds.
That's right. That is right. That's the last step is you just turn it completely around. Yeah, turnarounds. But sometimes people tell me that are new in the work, they're like, that's the trickiest part that I get a little bit mixed up on. So that's, you know, makes sense. But it's a little confusing, but really, it's taking your original thought and actually turning it around to the opposite and in several different ways. Like, for example, something terrible will happen, complete opposite, something wonderful will happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just noticing what each one feels like, you know, it's the difference. And could that be just as true? Even though I went through hard stuff in my past, could something wonderful happen?
Exactly, nice. And you kept your eyes open, and you learned and improved.
Yeah,
and think how different you are now compared to how you were 25 years ago.
Oh, I know, I love it.
And how enlightened you are, mm-hmm. and how really, Grace, because I know you. Mm-hmm. I mean, not really well, but I've known you over. Anyway, I know you pretty well. And you are a balanced woman. Work, play, dance. You're balanced.
Yes.
And so many people want to be more balanced, and they have trouble with that because of overwhelming anxiety, which, of course, is at the base of a lot of eating disorders and sexual dysfunctions. And so it does... The mindfulness piece, I want to, before the show ends, I want to talk a little bit more about that because I think that parents or those of us who are older, with adult children, but mostly it's parents with younger children, can be role models by eating pleasurably and mindfully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who binge or binge purge tend to eat mindlessly.
Yes, true. Yeah. Well, it is like this. I love that being mindful is more popular and well known. Like what that is, you know, mindful. Just kind of, but it for me, it's a sense of slowing down and taking in instead of such a limited view. It's interesting is the word mindful, because for me it almost has more, I'm opening up to feeling the whole body and feeling feelings and having a sensing experience of food and eating or the room that I'm in or the people that I'm with, you know. Kind of funny because maybe even there's less, it doesn't mean thinking, you know. I mean, my thoughts are there, but there's more than just thought that I'm relying on as I'm picking up just my conversation with reality in a way. So being mindful and being mindful with food, like really letting yourself taste it. I have people, this is one little fun thing I just thought was so great. I learned it from somewhere else. It's where when you smell your food, which I like calling the first course, because you're taking in something when you breathe, you know, you're just like taking in, just like we take in food. But then to say, like to smell it and go, like that. Like, you know.
Through your nostrils, breathing it in. Ah, yes.
Oh, it smells so good. And just letting yourself have the enthusiasm and the gusto and the joy of like, oh, my, and how interesting it is, all the different smells. You know?
Yes.
Because there's so much, when you're eating, with that mindless, what we're calling mindless eating, it's kind of panicked eating sometimes and graze eating, like a low-level anxiety eating. It's, you're kind of fast, and you can't, very fast sometimes. You can't even really, not tasting entirely everything that you're eating. You're definitely not saying, oh, this is wonderful, like in a celebratory way. It's more guilt eating. It's guilty and angry eating. And it's wonderful to be that way with foods, especially sometimes people discover, I thought that was my favorite, quote unquote, forbidden food. Like, I love talking about, let's not have forbidden and not forbidden anymore. But people will have,
Well,
that's, so people like, this is forbidden. And then they'll bring it in. They might have, like, somebody, this wonderful, at their eating peace retreat, somebody was bringing in her favorite Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And right there, sitting right there at her place, We all eat together, and I even guide people now, take a bite, you know, and so they get to just slow it all down. And she was sharing afterwards, I am shocked because I might not like that ice cream as much as I thought I liked it.
<It's> like,
you actually get to find out what you really might like.
By slowing down, savoring, perhaps letting it linger in your mouth.
Yeah.
And on your tongue.
Yeah.
And swallowing slowly.
Yeah.
And of course, slowing down and savoring can enhance one's sexuality and one's sex life enormously.
Exactly. Enormously. Like, just, I mean, oh, you know, just letting everything be there at the same time. And I have people write down their thoughts, you know, in case their mind starts chattering about, oh my God, you know, I can't believe you're eating this in front of other people, or her food looks better over there that she's got, you know, or whatever absurd things you're noticing. Just, it's okay that they're there too. We don't have to fight them. Chatter, 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 you know, let it be.
Chatter, 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 just acknowledging that my mind is kind of chattering and all these old beliefs are taking notice.
Yes, and, you know, I found that it's kind of a sweet thing to do when you're getting to know somebody. I've been married and are together with my husband for about 10 years now, so we know each other well. It's beautiful, but I remember maybe at the beginning more, but we'll still be this way. It's like, if the chatter gets louder, this is sort of thoughts to say, oh, I got to check something out with you. You know, like we say it. I mean, because we're safe to share, or, you know, and whatever's going on. And that's a really sweet, kind of beautiful, it's a very dynamic, kind of a live conversation. And so I like that can be true in attraction and in sex and sexuality and eating. So like having a favorite, instead of it being an enemy or something you have to be really, really careful about, you can speak your part, you know, like go ahead and share if you feel a little anxious about something or you're not positive or whatever. It's just being able to be very genuine, guilt-free. I like how Byron Katie, she says, happiness is a guilt-free experience.
Ha ha. Happiness is a guilt-free experience.
Yeah.
I like that. And
isn't that just good?
She also said at the end of the Oprah interview that I saw on YouTube, if you argue with it, you miss the beauty.
Yeah.
If you argue with, is it true, you know, and all of the other questions, you miss the beauty.
Yeah. You really do. I mean, you just feel like what that's like when you're against something. Like, you know, you feel a big no, and it doesn't mean you're wrong and you should flip it and say, like, oh, it should be a yes, something that's a no. But it's just noticing, engaging in an argument, going to war. And I like how she'll say, argue with reality and you lose, but only 100% of the time. So that's interesting.
Only 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's a remarkable person. And you got facilitated, I think you said this in our show last month, that you were one of the last people that got accredited as a facilitator for Byron Katie? Or,
yeah,
is that right?
It is. She's had a program for a long time, and now there's with the Institute for the Work, and there is an end date for when she's no longer going to facilitate people. And it's still 2 years from now-ish. So there's still people finishing their certification program, and there's all the certified facilitators that are all out there that have done lots of hours, many hours of just basically doing their own work. You know, it's very powerful. So it's still underway for a while, but there's an end point. You know, get everything done by X time, because after this, from that point forward, no more certification program.
And maybe she's saying, you're on your own, and I'm semi-retired.
Yeah, maybe so. Exactly. Well, I like
she strikes me as a woman who wants to stay engaged, though. And that's actually very important for successful aging, to stay engaged and continue to want to make a difference. And that's why I'm continuing, and I have no plans of retirement. I hope that works out, and I think it should.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, there is something I really love what you've mentioned about. There is something absolutely amazing and totally unexpected and magnificent about entering the wisdom of elderhood. And I have this other mentor who really talks a lot about how that's been very diminished in our culture. It's like nobody wants to be aging, and there's a lot of funny things going on with aging, but how you're holding that with appreciation, all that you've learned and how absolutely amazing it is. I mean, I'm finding that. I wouldn't trade this age for any other younger age. It's like every day is more peaceful and interesting and exciting and fantastic. The drama is just not present, which is fantastic.
Isn't that a relief?
Yes.
Yeah,
it is.
Of course, I see it in my clients a lot. There's just way too much drama, so we work to diminish the drama. Which often works very well by having extra good communication and extra good connection. I'm going to wrap this up now. Through slow meals together, gourmet, maybe aphrodisiac meals together, and through slow sex together, really taking your time, savoring both. There's my music. That means we're ending. Thank you so much, Grace.
Thank you. Awesome.
You'll be back.
I will.
Goodbye, everybody.
Se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore, ma i tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta, ma i tuoi piedi, ta.